This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from BFM 89.9. I'm Meera Sivasudhi. Now, after 8 years on the air, we're bringing the Bigger Pictures Health and Living to you, live, on the ground. A whole day with the experts, debunking myths behind heart disease and diabetes, addressing our love affair with food. Of course, George will be there talking about sperm. So join us at BFM's Health and Living Live 2016 on Saturday, 2nd of April. Go on and register at bfm.my/health. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasudhi. He's had an illustrious career as an anesthesiologist. He spent 50 years in academia, and today we meet the man behind the surgical mask to learn more about his clinical milestones, views on medical ethics, and the improvements in anesthetics. We might even touch a bit on the former national captain's cricket career. Welcome to the show, Emeritus Professor Dr. Alex E. Dalalkan, who's an anesthesiologist. Welcome to the show. How are you, Professor?
I'm still alive and fully functional.
82 years and 82 still involved in academia.
82 years young.
Yes.
Not old.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, you want to just tell me a little bit about your childhood, your upbringing, your educational background. I understand you were born and bred in Singapore.
Yeah, actually my parents had come from Ceylon in the early 30s, actually. And I was born in Singapore on the in 1934. You know, and then of course, school, did everything in Singapore. Even was in Singapore during the Japanese occupation, and then finished school, and then I actually didn't sort of want, you know, with passion to be a doctor and all that jazz. In fact, I wanted to be a veterinary surgeon, and I remember my teachers. That's why I ask students nowadays, you know. Why did you take up medicine? I've done some surveys on this. And many give the various reasons, family. But I think teachers sometimes influence you a lot. Because I remember I had fairly good results in the O-level senior Cambridge exams in Singapore. And the teachers, you know, they'll categorize students according to their results. If you got good results, you must do medicine. If you not next down the rung of the ladder would be you must take up engineering. Next would be law, and fourth would be the arts and humanities. Yeah?
So what made you change your mind?
So when I finished off, I happened to get good results, you know? And mind you, I was a sportsman. You know? I captained Singapore at cricket when I was a schoolboy. And I happened to get good results. So the teacher said, no, you must take up medicine. So I said, no, I want to take up veterinary surgery because I loved animals. But then, you know, so the teacher said, well, if you love animals, you want to help poor animals or what suffering, etc., why don't you do it for human beings? So I said, okay. I sort of said, okay, I'll go along with that. And that's how I ended up in medicine.
Mm-hmm. And why anesthesiology?
Yeah, so anyway, then I graduated. In fact, when I was in the first year in Singapore, I'll never forget, because I was a sportsman. And people knew me more because of my sports.
Of course, you bowled out a very prominent Australian in 1978, was it?
No,
1964, okay.
28th of March, anyway.
See, your memory versus mine.
So I just, you know, went along and I had to wear a little label on my forehead, you know, during the ragging period, the seniors ragging and all that. And it said, national sportsman, medical student, sure fail one, in the typical Singapore English, you know, sure fail one. Yeah? And I said, yeah, okay, I put it on. I managed, mind you, I failed exams, you know. I'm very proud.
You did?
I tell students this, you know, during my medical thing. I failed exams. I said, I'm very proud, you know. I failed an exam, you know. But today, I'm emeritus professor. So what I'm trying to tell students is, passing an exam doesn't mean you'll be a good doctor, you know? I think this is one of the things that's cropping up today. You know, you read in the papers and everybody giving talks about there are too many doctors coming out in this country because too many medical schools. I think people are missing the point, you know, that when a person passes an exam and graduates from a medical school, there are many mushrooming all over the place in this country, you are not a doctor, you know? You're a graduate with a piece of paper. Now you have to undergo training. You have to undergo your house officer jobs, which is 2 years training. And then if you want to specialize, 4 years at least of medical officer training. Okay? Now that is the point. This production line of graduates is escalating. But you need trainers to train people. And there are not enough trainers. That is the problem. Not that there are too many doctors. There are not enough trainers to train the graduates. And that's why you're going to get in a serious problem. I think if things go on as they are. In fact, I presented a paper once in 2006 where I predicted and showed figures that at the rate we were producing graduates and our trainer population was static or going down, well, this was mushrooming on the other side. I said at the rate we're going, because roughly a guideline is when a chap finishes his house, his exams and becomes a houseman, he has roughly a ratio, one trainer to five trainees roughly. But at the rate we're producing people to be trained, and the trainer population going down, you will get situations as it is now, 1 to 20 odd. So the quality of the product will go down.
Of course.
And if you keep going like this, I showed the figures that in 2020, if we continue producing graduates mushrooming all over the place and not enough trainers, we will, and if we try to maintain the 1 to 5, there will be 23,000 house officers just graduated waiting for a posting, lining up. And there will be no training boss.
Absolutely. You were instrumental in the setup of the first ICU in University Hospital.
Yeah. No, to get back to the thing about how I took up anesthesiology. That's why as I graduated, then I went to Penang, I did my house job. I didn't want to take up anesthesia. Anesthesia is very... sort of unpopular field.
Yeah.
Because I heard you sort of introducing me as with my surgical mask. You know, people always think that anesthetist is somebody who hides under the sarong of the surgeon or something. Is that, you know? And
No longer, however.
No, that's what. Today, it's quite different. The anesthesiologist, if you look up, we have a specialist register in this country now. You know, when people graduate, you have to do your house officership, provisional registration 2 years, then you medical officer registration, and then if you specialize, you go on the specialist register. And if you look up Malaysian Medical Council, please make this clear. I would like to make this clear. I'm talking about Malaysian Medical Council. That is the body that has the statutory powers to deal with doctors in this country. So the Malaysian Medical Council has set up a specialist register. And if you look up anesthesiologists today, specialty, his specialty and expertise is anesthesiology and critical care. That's the difference. I'm a critical care specialist. You know? And critical care covers a bigger area, not just giving gas.
Yeah.
You know, when many people think anesthetists give gas and put people to sleep, my answer to them is, I can give gas to various orifices in the body, one of which, if you like, I can give it to your anus. Because my son, who's a law graduate, he always disturbs me and says that anesthesiologists are anesthesiologists.
So, and hence, because you were a critical care specialist as well, went on to set up.
So, and how I went into anesthesia was because nobody wanted to take up anesthesia, and they were short of fillers in Penang, and I could mechanically put tubes into orifices. So that's how I took it. Right? And then the first qualified anesthesiologist came back from England and to Penang. And then I sort of understood what I was doing. And then suddenly I felt, this is what I tell students or young doctors. They'll come and ask, what discipline shall I take up in my career and all. My answer is this, which I went through. I was in different fields, surgery, medicine, pediatrics, etc. But I, when you find yourself, this is in all aspects of life, when you and work, when you find yourself that you're happy at work, that's your field. But if you have to go every morning and, you know, unhappy, I got 10 hours, 8 hours of suffering before me, get out. Mm-hmm. That's not your field. So I found myself happy. Suddenly, say, hey, I'm happy. I'm enjoying what I'm doing. And that's how I took up medicine.
And you came from Penang to KL.
Yeah, and then they brought me back. I told you, Dhanraj Tan Sri, the late, who started the medical faculty on the request by Tunku Abdul Rahman, because there was only one university before it started in KL. There was only one University of Malaya in Singapore. So all Malayans, I told you, like my wife or girlfriend at that time, had to come down to Singapore to study. You know? So, and I remember Tunku got hold of T.J. Dhanraj and said, set it up, that's all. Money, no problem, anything. And the old man, who was quite a character, but he did what I think nobody else could have done in the world. He set up within 5 years or 3 years a superb medical faculty, at least. The university was started in 62, and then he set it up in 63, the medical faculty. A university of standard that was acceptable internationally.
So this is Tan Sri Dhanraj, who set up the medical faculty.
Who set up the medical faculty
of University of Malaya.
Which is the first medical school. And everybody who graduated from University of Malaya, the first graduates came out in 68, they have been my student in some way. Maybe they just heard my jokes and nothing else. because that time, teaching anesthesia was nonsense. Teaching undergraduates, this is what I've changed today. When I teach at the universities under the anesthetic posting, you know, when they get their postings, I do not teach anesthesia to undergraduates because I think that's damn stupid. Because the undergraduate, what the hell, what does he want to know about how to give gas and things like that? You know?
So what are you teaching?
So I teach critical care. Care of the unconscious. Care of the unconscious and critical care. Critical care, there are four aspects. Perioperative care. Peri. That means pre, per, post. That means you have to see your patient, check your patient. This is mandatory, you know, and medical legal. If you do not see your patient and you go and just give gas in the theater and something happens, you're finished. Mm-hmm. Because you didn't see your patient pre-op. Today, this is perioperative care. Pre, inside a theater, of course, you give anesthesia with the surgeon. And then postoperatively, you must bring the patient back. That's your responsibility. You put him to sleep under anesthesia. Now you have to bring him back in the recovery room. And then only if he's alert enough and conscious enough, then you can certify that he can go back to the ward safely. So it's not just giving gas. So perioperative care is one big aspect. And the second aspect is resuscitation, care of the unconscious. Somebody's gone unconscious suddenly, you know, and how to resuscitate the person. The third aspect is care of the prolonged unconscious, that is in the intensive care. You know, somebody on a machine, unconscious, etc. And then the fourth aspect is pain relief. The anesthetist the origin of anesthesia was to relieve the pain of the surgical knife. And the first anesthetic given in UK at least was on the 16th of October, 1846. You know, and then it spread. But in fact, the first anesthetic given was a disaster. It was given by a dental fella for a dental procedure in a big auditorium, you know. And the damn thing didn't work. And the patient got up and ran off.
This is in the UK. in the UK.
This is history. Right?
Of course. We're just getting to know, getting up close and personal with Emeritus Professor Dr. Alex Delokan, who's an anesthesiologist.
Critical care specialist.
And also spent 50 years in academia at his age of 82.
Spending and counting.
51 years.
Now it's coming to 51. Yes. 1st June.
He's 82
years young.
Yeah. and
I say this openly, you know, in court. I still am called to court.
Yeah.
You know, when something goes wrong with a patient or whatever it is, and I'm called in to give my expert opinion about what went wrong or should have been done or should not have been done. And I go in, and quite often some young pipsqueak of a lawyer will say, you know, I say, Professor, how old are you? You know, very old, you know. It's emphasizing the word old so that everybody will think, oh, this Alzheimer's fellow in Alzheimer's disease or something. And I turn around and I tell the judge usually, I said, my lord, I'm not old. Chronologically, I'm 82 years, but I'm 82 years young. And I tell this openly in court. Because age is a number, but to be old, there are three factors, you know. One is chronology, number of years. Second is physiologically. Are you functional? Mm-hmm. I am. My lord, I'm fully functional physiologically. I've got all my body functions going.
What do you think has kept you going? Academia?
Well, I think one of the things, of course, I went along with my sports right through my medical career. And I think sports and medicine taught me a few things. For instance, sports taught me how to take defeat. You take defeat. You have to. You can't win all the time. Mm-hmm. And even in medicine, you do your best. You try your best. Sometimes it succeeds. Sometimes it won't. You got to accept that. So this acceptance of you are not always the winner, I think, sort of got through me. And as you were mentioning, how did I get into sort of this state of mind today? My crusade in life is to, you know, see what is done best for the patient. And I saw a few things when I was in my younger years in Penang and all. And I think one famous one was when I saw things being done by doctors and in the hospital or something, it shook me, you know. How can you do this to people? And that's how ethics, I was a bum as a medical student, sportsman, etc., you know. But somehow or other, something was implanted in me. That when I saw certain things, it stirred me, you know. Hey, you cannot do these things, you know.
So we'll come back and find out more about medical ethics, medical legal cases, which, you know, an anaesthetist is very much prone to or exposed to. And Professor Delokan also has a little booklet which he's shared with me, which he shares with his students on death and what really constitutes death. That's coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. You're still here. Good. Now, if you're listening to this podcast while on the treadmill, you're already off to a good start. If you're not, don't forget to join us at BFM's Healthy Living Live 2016 on the 2nd of April. Find out how you can live a better, healthier life. Go on and register at bfm.my/health. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasothi. We're getting up close and personal with Emeritus Professor Dr. Alex Delokan, who's a critical care specialist, anesthesiologist as well, an academician, spending this year will be 51 years. And Dr. Delokan is actually 82 years young this year. Yeah. And we're very proud to, you know, have him in the studio with us today. Dr. Alex was born and bred in Singapore. He was trained in Singapore, in the University of Malaya in Singapore, were you? And came back, fell in love with somebody in the arts. You spent a lot of time in the arts department, professor, as a medical student, didn't you?
Yep. Instead of being in the medical library, I used to go to the arts library.
And there was a very good reason for that.
Yeah, and to reconnoiter the field.
which led him to Penang after, as a result of hanging around in the arts department. And you came back to Kuala Lumpur, Professor, and you set up the first ICU in University Malaya, University Hospital.
Well, not me alone. I was, there are two of us actually, Professor Ganendran, he was the head of department then, and I was his lecturer. And we set up the first intensive care ward in the country. And this was on the 18th, officially launched on the 18th of January 1969. It was first set up at the University Hospital, which was the first teaching hospital, which was set up in 1966-67. And how it came about, of course, intensive care was something that had been set up around the world, but took a bit of time to come to Malaysia. And it started off in Copenhagen, in Denmark, in the early 50s, when there was an epidemic of poliomyelitis, which affected the breathing muscles of the teenagers who were rushing in, who were being brought into the hospital. In those days, there was no mechanical ventilators and things like that. All they could do was put a tube in and squeeze a bag and give some oxygen. But you needed somebody to squeeze a bag. So they had to get manual squeezers, you know. And then that's how it started. And then they realized, and these patients were spread all over the hospital, dying patients, next to any other patient. And they didn't get the intensive care that was required to save the life. So then suddenly the idea occurred, why not bring all these patients into one big hall and treat them all the same with intensive nursing care, bedside, next to the patient, one patient, one nurse per patient per second. That's the concept that came in, and they saved a lot of lives. And then this idea grew suddenly. It wasn't a planned project. It was just many things in medicine evolved, you know, and developed. And then the thing went around the world. And today, every hospital that admits patients who are acutely ill, in danger of dying or seriously ill, must have an intensive care. If not, the plans wouldn't be approved for the hospital.
I mean, just listening to you, I cannot imagine that we didn't have intensive care until the 1960s.
Yeah, the patients died, you know?
Yeah.
So this is where, when we set up the intensive care, the candidate patient who was brought into intensive care, because the beds were very scarce, because very expensive to run, you know, one nurse per patient per second, etc., with the best monitors and machines and everything now. It's about, I don't know, it's about 3,000 ringgit a day, which will be, of course, billed to the relatives of somebody who's on a machine in the ICU,
yeah.
You know. So it's an expensive thing. So, and you can't have hundreds of beds for these people. And the recommendation from the international bodies was 1 to 2% of the total bed strength of the hospital. And when we first started the University Hospital KL, the bed strength was 756 or something. So taking it at about 800, we had an 8-bedded ICU, 1%. 800 beds, total bed strength.
Mm-hmm.
So 1%, 8 beds.
Yeah.
So now the beds are limited. Now, which, and there's so many patients requiring to be saved life, because the actual sort of trigger point for a patient to be a candidate to come into ICU would be that he has a failing vital system. Now, the vital systems for you to be alive as a human being are your heart function, your heart, your lungs, your brain, your liver, your kidney, the vital system. If one of them is failing and needs artificial support, drugs or machines, etc., that is to save his life, because the vital system is failing, without this support, he would die.
Mm-hmm.
He's a candidate for ICU. That was the first sort of thing.
Must have been hard for you to make decisions.
Now the decision, who comes in?
Yeah.
Because 8 beds. Yeah? So we had to put this priority, the failing vital system which needs artificial support without which he would die. But even with that, you would get patients with no hope. They're dying. which we are having today. And this is called futile therapy. There are people who put the patient in ICU for what? If the patient is dying, no hope, you can't save his life, let him die. I'm in my books, the latest book I've just completed now in scripting is on, one of the chapters is on futile therapy that is being practiced in some places.
But does that not go against the oath that you take when you qualify as a doctor?
When you?
Qualify as a doctor. Does that go against the oath that you take to keep the person alive?
No, but I mean, you've got to be practical also, is it? You're not keeping him alive. You're delaying his dying. There's a difference between dying and alive, you know? And he's dying. Let's say a 99-year-old person with advanced cancer sprouting out from every orifice in the body, and he's gasping, and he's going to die. What are you achieving by putting a tube and sending him to the machine where he will die? Mm-hmm. Where today we can go by brain death. He can be on the machine and dead. So what are we trying to achieve? When you have time, you get the relatives and explain, look, and they will understand there's no hope. And we are going to prolong dying. And the emotional strain of the relatives having to come every day and cry and they can't communicate with somebody on the machine, it is terrible, you know. And you know there's no hope of salvage. Mm-hmm. So what are we trying to do? This is called futile therapy.
Hence your little booklet titled Dead or Alive.
Yeah. Where
you want to just quickly tell me about what's in it?
Yeah. Basically is what is death. In fact, I gave this talk at Bali at a conference a couple of years ago about ethical issues in the ICU. And futile therapy was one of them. Should we bring in people with no hope and what are we trying to achieve? Mm-hmm. Is it? So the thing about ICUs was we had to be a bit strict. And because so many patients, if you see a patient with a good outlook, good prognosis, salvageable, surely that patient should take priority against a person who's no hope. So we had to, it is a horrible thing to do. And the head of ICU, I used to have sleepless nights, you know, after making a decision, mm-hmm. saying, no, this one comes in, that one, no. Did I make the right choice? You know, but somebody had to make the decision. You know? So we followed this criteria, like somebody who's having a failing vital system, which is failing, which needs artificial support, without which he would die. Number one, that's one. But even that, we had to have a second clause to say that the prognosis and the outlook should be good and salvageability, number two. A third one, of course, is that, you know, sometimes we might think, you know, if there's a bed, and sometimes if we think we make a medical decision, doctors can make mistakes, you know, because we are making it. But so long as you made a mistake thinking what you did was best for the patient, but you made a wrong decision. Medical errors are acceptable. So this was the ICU. Then we set it up and patients were coming in and everybody was cheering. Because death, as explained, I was brought up. And there are two ways doctors diagnose and certify death. One is the old conventional, traditional one, heart stop, breathing stop. You try and reverse it, CPR or whatever it is, fail. So it's called irreversible cardiorespiratory arrest. Irreversible. Mm-hmm. You try it, fail, cannot. Dead. And this is still applicable in outlying areas of the country, rural areas, etc., where you have small little hospitals with no ICU facilities. So if a patient dies, has a cardiorespiratory arrest in its outlying areas, you'll have to go by the old traditional, conventional definition of death, which is irreversible cardiorespiratory arrest, dead. But in the bigger hospitals today, this is where as we evolve, the paradox is we created more problems. We had a patient with cardiorespiratory arrest. today resuscitation has improved so much. We could put a tube, do external cardiac massage, gives drugs, etc. And we got back the heartbeat. And then we put the tube, put on a machine. So we got back the breathing, the arrested respiration. We got the machine breathing for the patient, ventilating. And then we used drugs to maintain the blood pressure to keep the heart pumping. And then the ECG was back. So everybody was cheering and said, we brought back the dead. You see? It was like Lazarus rise up from the dead, you know, as Jesus Christ is supposed to have said this in the Bible. Arise, Lazarus, from the dead, and Lazarus arose. So we brought back Lazarus, you know, on the machine.
Yeah.
And everybody was cheering. Then we got suddenly in situations where after a certain time, we tried to come out. You know, after we got things settled, we tried to come off the machines. We couldn't. So we had to carry on and on and on and on. And then we were thinking, what the hell are we doing? We're ventilating for a second, but we can't come off. And then the world literature, you know, suddenly realized there's such a thing called brain death, you know. And in fact, I went to the World Congress on intensive care and all that in Kyoto. I remember in Japan, 1989 or 1988. And there I presented the problems about diagnosing death in the ICU by brain death in the developing countries because we didn't have the facilities. And then all the things came through and today we can diagnose death on the machine in the ICU.
Fantastic.
Brain death. Then it's the doctor's duty and ethical duty, responsibility, to disconnect the hospital equipment attached to the patient whom you said is dead. So disconnect and release the body for the relatives to bury. That is what we should do. But doctors in this country till now, this is all settled. The medical profession has sent out documents, etc., to guide doctors that we can diagnose and certify death two ways. One, by the old cardiorespiratory arrest, non-reversible in outlying areas where there's no ICU facilities. The second one is, with ICU facilities, we get caught into this situation on the machine, ECG going, so you can diagnose death by brain death criteria, which can be done at the bedside. So we got two ways now. And this is where, when I went to this conference in Bali, and I created a bit of a uproar because it was a seminar, a world convention sort of thing with religious bodies and all. What is death? That was they were trying to discuss. So I said, medically we are quite clear. We've got finite points. You know, a person who's dying, and then at certain points we can say he's dead. He's dead. Death by cardiorespiratory arrest. Or death by brain death. So they were asking, so I said, philosophically, our religious, you know, people will say, death is when the soul leaves the body. So I just asked them, and they were a bit irritated or annoyed, I think. And I said, can you please tell me when does the soul leave the body?
And how do you
and
know?
I'm supposed to be a Catholic. You know?
Yes.
So many of the, in fact, the Pope's emissary, I remember, was at this conference, and they were all muttering and murmuring and saying, is he a Catholic? You know? How can he talk like that? So once I get worked up, sometimes I can't control my mouth. So I said, if you can't tell me when the soul leaves the body, can you tell me when the body leaves the soul? Mm-hmm. And there's a bigger uproar.
But it's obvious medically you're very clear.
Well, that's what I mean. So that's why I say a doctor, in whatever he does, and I when I go to court even, and I say doctors should do what they feel is best for their patient under the circumstances that they're in. You know, many doctors are called in for inquiry, why did you do this, why did you do that, you know. I tell them, the simple answer, young doctors are often blamed when something goes wrong, you know. So I tell the young doctor, he says, you just get up and said, I did what I did, what I thought was best for my patient under the circumstances that I was in. I was alone at night, alone, house officer, nobody around. So I did this, you know. wrong. I did wrong. Wrong decision. Mm-hmm. But why did you do it? This is the point. Why did you do it? So, have it clear in your conscience. I did what I did, what I thought was best for the patient under the circumstances that I was in. They can't kill you for that. They can't put you under ISA or NSC or whatever it is and send you to jail or something. They cannot.
Excellent. If you want to contribute or you want to ask Dr. and Alex a question, text us 016-201-9000. You can tweet BFM Radio. We have a question here from Aryaratnam, Professor Delacan. He's asking, what was Professor Delacan's feeling when he bowled Gary Sobers for duck at the Selangor Club Padang in 1964? We'll come back and address that up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. It's our Health and Living segment. We have Emeritus Professor Dato Dr. Alex Delacan, a critical care specialist and anesthesiologist, spent 51 years, or spending already 51 years in academia and still going at the age of 82. And Dr. Delacan is interesting personality, not just a medical expert, set up the first ICU together with Professor Ganesan, did you say?
Ganendran,
back in the 1960s, and still contributing very much towards students and their development. You were a very good sportsman, especially in cricket, Professor Alex. We have a question from Ari. He's asking what your feeling was like when you bowled out Gary Sobers for duck at the Selangor Club Padang in 1964.
Yeah. I think this question typifies what, you know, whenever people come across me, and I used to be known in Singapore as that national sportsman who took up medicine part-time. So anyway, here I am here, supposed to be giving a little talk on medical things, etc. And slam bang comes this question about what were my thoughts. Well, let me tell you, I have been asked this question thousands of times. You know, when I saw this guy, you know, who was supposed to be the greatest in the world and all that sort of thing, and I had to bowl to him. I did what I often do in medicine, you know. I question myself. Now, you've got a problem in front of you, and there are different ways of dealing with the problem. Choose the technique that in your hands are the best technique. They may not be the best technique available in the world, but in my hands, they're the best technique. So anyway, so I do this in medicine also. If I have to treat a person, I will use the technique that I know best. There may be better techniques, but I don't know them. Mm-hmm. So I follow this. So in this situation, so I looked at this guy, Gary Sobers, and I said, well, you're the greatest in the world. I'm nobody. And then I used a few expletives, you know, which I can't say over the air or can't let it go, you know. I use a few words to myself, you know, and I said, I will do this to you, you know, who the hell, you may be the greatest, I'm nobody, but I will show you a few things. And then I used the ball that I know best to bowl, a leg break, and I bowled a leg break and it went right through the gate and bowled him.
You know? Fantastic.
So I just, you know, when this is what I teach students, you know. I say, when you're confronted with a situation and there are so many different ways of doing it, don't say, oh, this is the latest technique, so I must use that technique. But in your hands, maybe out-of-date technique, but it is safest for the patient. So same in sports, use the technique that you know best.
You know, it's an honor to have you here with us, but it's a bigger honor, actually, that you have... Is it one of your daughters, Rinzi Delalkan, who's listening from Perth at the moment?
My son.
Your son,
He's the guy who turned around and said that I'm an anesthesiologist. He's a law graduate.
So he's listening to my dad from Perth. He says, tell him we're so proud of the eye doctor. How did the eye doctor come into play?
This is the other thing.
Yes.
He tells everybody that, oh, my father is a famous eye doctor. So I keep telling him.
Why?
So I tell people, I'm not a bloody eye doctor. I'm an anesthesiologist or anesthesiologist and critical care specialist. But he meant that I'm an eye doctor is that I'm so egoistic that whenever I say every sentence I start, I did this, I did that,
right.
I did it, so I'm the eye doctor.
The eye doctor, yeah. Right. Okay, he's very proud of you, though. Yeah. We have a question here from, we don't have a name, but this person says, my mother died in the hospital. Her eyes were closed. Her body was taken to the mortuary. And the next morning when we claimed her body, her eyes were open. Can this happen? I'm still bothered by this. Can you explain?
Oh, yes. I mean, if a person is certified dead by the international criteria, he's dead. Certified dead, he's dead, that's all. For instance, like brain death. Yeah? The people say, yeah, brain dead people, are you sure the person won't wake up or something? No. If you follow the criteria, international criteria to diagnose brain death criteria, and you sign everything, the person is dead, that's it. Now, when the dead body is moved, sometimes some people accidentally might just touch the head, and the eyelids might just come apart. That's all. It's not that the person opened her eyes. No. If the person was correctly certified dead, they cannot open their eyes in the mortuary.
Have mistakes been made?
Well, not if the criteria to diagnose. Mind you, if the person is not dead but his brain damaged, the eyes can be open. The person can be talking to you, but it's brain damage, what is called PVS, persistent vegetative state. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, when a person is what they call dead or unconscious, it doesn't mean the eyes must be closed. You know? The eyes can be open, but different levels of unconsciousness.
I mean, something we call use very commonly is the word coma.
Yeah, this was the old sort of criterion to demarcate coma, you know, that the person who's unconscious must be with his eyes closed. Mm-hmm. Not true. I mean, that doesn't work out. Because you can be with your eyes closed and you can be hearing. You know, there are some people you hear who seem to be sleeping at interviews and things like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah? But I've been with these people, you know, talking to them and they're snoring, yeah. You know. And then suddenly they wake up and say, yes, I agree with you.
Right. So if you are certified dead, you know, then, yeah, of course.
No,
you
if you're
are
certified dead correctly,
yep.
You cannot wake up.
Okay. So if you're in a brain dead situation,
yeah.
Then you're not certified dead.
No. You can be certified dead by brain death mm-hmm. criteria. You're dead, that's all.
Okay.
But there are two ways of certifying death. I told you one is, heart stop, breathing stop, can't be reversed, dead, outlying areas. In the ICU, you can be dead on the machine. Your eyes can be even open,
yeah.
You know? But you're dead by brain death criteria. So we do brain stem testing, and then we say the brain stem is gone, the person is dead. Two specialists do this, and they sign. 6 hours later, they repeat the testing. And if it's the same, the sign, the person is dead. Finished.
Okay.
He's dead.
As an anesthesiologist, you open up yourself to a lot of medico-legal cases. How have you coped with that over the years?
Well, I'm still going to court, and I'm called, you know. And I'll never forget one of the famous cases was the Bijani twins, you know, who were brain joined in Singapore, where they were operated, 29-year-old, law graduates from Iran.
Yeah.
And they ended up in Singapore, and the Singapore people said, no, they can do it. It had never been done in the world. Adult, what they call craniopagus, where the heads are joined, you know, joined at the head. But Singapore said, no, they can do, you know, etc. So they they did it, you know. And they did a good job. They prepared the patient, the pre-op, everything was very good. And they got the consent. Now, the consent, this is where today you got to be careful about consent taking. Huh? The patients said that they accept the possibility of dying on the table. That's so legally covered. So they took this. They died on the table. They bled to death. So now the point is, what was wrong about it? Well, I was asked this question, and at that time I was the president of the Medical Legal Society of this country, and I was asked this question, and I said, morally and ethically, they were wrong. Morally and ethically, not legally, morally. If somebody comes to you, you're the doctor, and says, doctor, I want you to do this operation, and you know as a doctor that if I do it, you will die. So, but he's asking you to do it, so you do it. Come on, that's against all ethical, moral behavior to another human being, isn't it? In other words, you're assisting in his suicide.
Yeah.
He's coming to you and saying, doctor, I want to die, in other words. So you do it. And then, so medical, legally, you're covered. No. Morally and ethically, you're not covered. And that's why when I go to court, I give my opinion based on ethical principles of patient care, which comes under common law and justice, you know, common law and justice, and based on ethical principles. I'm not a lawyer, you know, and I will go to court and say, yes, the doctor did ethically right or ethically wrong.
How do you assess that?
Well, did he do what he did in the best interest of the patient, you know, or did he do because he was forced to do, or whether it was... You see, that's what I teach students today and young doctors. Whatever you do, for Malaysia, I'm not talking about other countries. When a patient comes to you for help, doctor, please help me. That's the cry, isn't it? So you respond. And you respond, you do what you can do best for the patient. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. But you manage the patient in the best interest of the patient. That's all. But sometimes it doesn't work. If you follow that principle, you can't be hauled up for anything, you know, that you did bad things to the patient and all that. Yeah. The patient, and you get the consent. But when you did it in the best interest of the patient. But to say that when the patient comes and tells you, doctor, please kill me, and you said, in his best interest, I killed him, I mean, that you're going to euthanasia, which is not acceptable in this country, or the law is silent in this country, and in many countries it's not acceptable, because this is where it comes to, you know, religion and things like that. Do you believe in God? Yeah? Well, I think, thank God, in this country we believe in God, you know. So, and I firmly believe God decides who lives and who dies. You know?
One last question before we go. Somebody wants to know, what are your views on organ donation, on people who are still alive after brain death?
No, they cannot be. That's what I said. If you're diagnosed brain dead, you're not alive. So you come under the category of cadaveric donor. You're dead. This is the difference. Nowadays, when organ donation comes in, you've got live donor, where the person is alive, and they can take out one of his kidneys or something and give it to another person, but he's alive. He's a live donor. But because brain death came in, as I said, without being planned, we suddenly realized we had the cadaveric donor because he's dead, but on a machine, so we could take his organ.
Harvest the organ.
Harvesting the organ and then do the organ transplantation. But today, in this country, we recommended the opt-in law.
Yes.
Opt-in.
Singapore has an opt-out.
Singapore has the opt-out.
Yep.
That's why I gave this talk at this World Congress, and I said, be careful if you're in Singapore. if you haven't signed this form, opt-out, you opted out,
yes.
They can take any organ from you and do what they want, as a joke. But in Malaysia, I believe we followed the correcting opt-in law. But still, we are having trouble.
Yeah.
you pledge in Singapore, in Malaysia, opt-in. I want to give my... So you're dead cadaveric donor, so we can take. But when it comes to the actual harvesting of the organ, the patient in the ICU, we still have to go out and get the permission, the family's consent, and then they won't give it.
Of course.
That is the block today in this country. Opt-in, fine, but pledge... the harvesting doesn't depend on the pledge. That's why I feel that perhaps they should amend the law and for organ transplantation. And at the time of pledging, when you pledge and you get your next of kin to agree, mm-hmm. witness, and they agree to your pledge. So that, and there it's all written that when you are a cadaveric donor, your organ will be taken out, you know, and they agree at that point. In other words, they agree to the harvesting.
Yeah.
Put it in the pledge.
Until such time, tell your next of kin that you have actually pledged. Yeah. I think that would be a step in the right direction.
Well, yeah.
You know, with so much more to talk about, I have so many questions. I've only asked you two.
Because I talk too much.
No. It's been a pleasure having you on, and we will have you back. I mean, there are so many other issues I'd like to explore with you. Thank you very much for joining us today. It was a pleasure.
The pleasure is mine.
Yeah. Would you have a message for Malaysians?
Well, I keep saying this in anything. You know, when people ask me, what's the message? You know, my message is keep the flag flying.
Thank you very much for joining us. Emeritus Professor Dato Dr. Alex Delalkan, a critical care specialist and anesthesiologist, academician. The list just goes on. Amazing national cricket player back in his heyday, talking to us, spending his afternoon with us on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.